Good afternoon and welcome to Hometown Alaska. I'm Kathleen McCoy. We're right in the thick of salmon harvest season here in Alaska. Tomorrow, August 10th, is an annual state-designated day to learn about and celebrate salmon. That's why we decided to invite experts onto today's show to talk about how fish policy is made, what science can tell us about how our salmon are doing, and to explore the cultural value of salmon among Alaska Natives. But of course, there is salmon news. Tomorrow also happens to be the start of a closure in southeast Alaska for king salmon commercial and sport fishing. It's a window into deep concern over how best to sustainably manage Chinook salmon so they continue to come back into our rivers year after year. Salmon is a huge topic, and we certainly can't cover everything. Our goal is to share information so together we better understand the state of salmon in Alaska. Here to help us, I'd like to welcome our guests. We have Dr. Dan Ranella, the Senior Fisheries Biologist for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Welcome, Dan.
Hi, thanks, Kathleen.
And you've got a long history in Alaska. You were at UAA for a couple of years, 16
more,
years.
More than a couple, 16 years at UAA, most recently with the Alaska Center for Conservation Science. And a little over a year ago, I moved over to the Anchorage Conservation Office with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
And always doing very similar kind of work around aquatic ecology.
Yeah, aquatic ecology, freshwater habitat, salmon ecology, those sorts of things.
For salmon, it's like, how's the water, right? Jump in or don't jump in? What's the quality of where they live?
That's a good way to look at it, yeah.
Okay. So, and then we also have Sam Cotton, Commissioner for Alaska Department of Fish and Game, a commercial fisherman in the past, a sport fisherman, a legislator. So welcome to the show, Commissioner.
Thank you very much, Kathleen. Happy to be here.
Really happy to have you. And then we also have Gayla Hossett, and she is from Dillingham. We're happy to have her in Anchorage today, but she's from Dillingham. And she is a senior fisheries, subsistence research specialist from Dillingham with the Bristol Bay Native Association, and also a fisher person herself, and really involved with her family in fishing. And so we'll hear both professional and personal sides from you, I think, today.
All right. Thank you, Kathleen.
Yeah. I just want to let our listeners know that they can participate in our conversation. They can call us here at 550-8433 in Anchorage or 1-888-353-5752, that's statewide, or we can also take an email at hometown@alaskapublic.org. And the last little bit of business is to say we have on alaskapublic.org under Hometown Alaska, we have a promo for this show, and we have a lot of links there of use to people who hear things on the show that are interesting to them, everything from some of the research that's being done in the Alaska Department of Fish and Game or in the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. We also have a link to the Bristol Bay Native Association and their natural resource page, just to sort of show a lot of people are working on these problems and looking for solutions and looking for good management. One other thing I want to let folks know about is the Salmon Fellows. I don't know if anybody here had heard about them, but it's the Alaska Humanities Forum has convened their first class of Salmon Fellows, and they're people from around the state that are talking about salmon. And They're commercial fishermen, they're scientists, they're historians. It's just really an interesting idea, and the idea is that people just talk about salmon and find common ground, and I just think that's an interesting idea. So we've got a link to that, and there's a recent magazine article about the Salmon Fellows if you'd like to read more about that. That's all on alaskapublic.org under Hometown Alaska. Okay, so now we're going to get to the conversation, and I was going to start with Commissioner Cotton. There's been recent news about salmon, something happening tomorrow about, the king fishery in southeast, commercial and sport, sort of an emergency closure. That sounds so dramatic, emergency closure. That was one thing that caught my eye. I also noticed that there's been a lot reported lately about coho and sockeye in Upper Cook Inlet, lots of back and forth on that. And then the other piece of news I picked up is that the sockeye are streaming back, just terrifically. And so I kind of wanted you to tell us a little bit about what's in the news and maybe how you've been engaged with that, or how you, the decision to close, to have an emergency closure, how those things happen.
Thank you, Kathleen. Yeah, there's a lot of things in the news, and this is a pretty active time for our department and for people in Alaska that are harvesting in all different ways, commercially and personal use, sport, subsistence. But to start with, on your first question dealing with southeast Chinook salmon closures, it's just as simple as this. It's a conservation issue. We've had very low returns on Alaska streams in southeast Alaska. Now it appears that similar situations are occurring in British Columbia and even Washington State, where a lot of the fish that are hatched in those areas swim in Alaska waters. So we have a treaty with Canada and the United States, Canada, and the state of Washington participates as well as the state of Alaska. So I think most people are accepting that we're, you know, on times of conservation concern, we close fisheries. So mm-hmm. we haven't really had a lot of outcry. There are some problems with it. Golden North King Salmon Derby in Juneau is not going to be able to operate. It'll be a Silver Salmon Derby. And there's other
switch species.
And I spoke to former Governor Frank Murkowski yesterday. His wife sponsors a tournament down in southern southeast that promotes breast cancer awareness. And he had heard they were going to have an exception for the Juneau Derby, but they weren't. So, as long as everybody's being treated equally, no problem. They'll fish for cohos instead.
And that was triggered by just the fish counts?
Yeah, we do a lot of different forms of research, but all indicators point to low abundance for not only this year's stock, but for the juveniles that will be returning in subsequent years. And so you have to reduce or eliminate harvest on those as well. They call them feeder kings. They aren't necessarily going to spawn this year, but they are, mm-hmm. are going to be back in a year
mm-hmm.
or two.
Mm-hmm. And how much science has got to be, your scientists over at the department have to be involved in this. I mean, they must be asking questions about what could it be? Why are we seeing low returns? Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, and it's a little frustrating because it's really hard to pin it down, but usually the scientists, and I'm sure that our other guests here today will have some comments on this, but typically a science crew will explore the potential options or the potential reasons. Water temperature that results in less zooplankton in the water, therefore there's less food, you have a run failure, and a lot of different things about the ocean can be not very suitable for salmon survival. Mm-hmm. And so the catchphrase is ocean conditions.
Mm. A big.
That's a big answer.
Big pool.
Yeah.
Right.
But you can also have localized problems on individual systems. But when it's systematic and widespread like this, it's typically ocean conditions and not necessarily always the same conditions that affect it.
So you're saying that news isn't terribly shattering for Southeast?
Well, it's going to be disappointing, but mm-hmm. I think most people, when you say, and we are able to show pretty convincingly that we have a conservation concern, I think people generally accept that. Mm-hmm. Most people want to see sustainability, and if it's a real conservation concern, I think people accept it.
Yeah, yeah. Anything, Gayla or Dan, you want to weigh in there on that, or just... We'll keep moving. Okay. I want to go to the coho and the sockeye up in Upper Cook Inlet. Tell us a little bit about that one, because that's been pretty newsy, too.
Well, we're dealing with that on a daily basis. There are, it starts with the Kenai Peninsula and almost always about the Kenai River. And so when you look at the Kenai River and the fish that are near there, you have... I think it's seven or eight different constituency groups. You have educational permits. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is now allowing a gillnet fishery for subsistence in the part of the Kenai that's in the refuge there. You have your sport fishermen. You have your guided sport fishermen. You have your personal use fishermen and your guided personal use fishermen.
Oh, my gosh.
You have
the
set netters and the drift netters.
Yeah.
And I don't know, that's seven or eight anyway. So there's often competing interests in there and advocacy to favor their particular interest.
Mm-hmm.
In addition, a lot of the coho salmon that are hoped for up in the valley streams also have to be considered. So that's yet another element that doesn't necessarily affect the Kenai River, but those fish swim in the upper part of the inlet, and the commercial fishermen have access to those fish as well. So we have to read our management plans, and that's how
You've
it all
got it
starts.
Right here.
I've got it with me.
Little pink copy right here.
And okay. We get as much data as we can. We have test fisheries. We look at the catch per unit effort of the commercial fleet. We have just any kind of data we can get. Up in the valley, we have weirs and fish counting stations, and so we're constantly searching for all the information we can get to help us make those kind of management decisions.
And as this has unfolded, who are you hearing from, or who's pushing back on it? Anybody? Or
I hear pretty consistently from the leadership and the commercial fishing groups. And they're advocates, and they make good points, and they've been doing this for a long time, and they will challenge us on our decisions to open, close, or restrict. We also hear from the folks in the Mat-Su. The borough has a Fish and Wildlife Commission with some very knowledgeable people that participate that are not necessarily advocates, but they're well-informed folks. Many of them have worked for the department or served on the fish board. So they're watching carefully to make sure we're paying attention to the what we're supposed to be doing as far as allowing coho salmon to get up in the valley. The politicians weigh in. Legislators want to get out in front and make sure their constituents know they're paying attention as well. So
everybody wants their piece of the pie, I guess you could say. But sometimes to allow fish to get farther upstream, you make decisions that at the beginning of the river that people don't always understand.
But it starts with the Board of Fish, and they produce a management plan, and they produce regulations. Actually, it starts with the statutes. The statutes authorize the fact that there is a commissioner, and that there is a department, and that there is a board. And then the board is assigned typically what's referred to as allocation decisions. So they'll decide who's supposed to get the fish, which groups, under which conditions, and as best they can, they'll prescribe that in the regulations in the management plan. But then we're left to do the day-to-day management based on the information that we have.
Right. Is there information that you wish you could get that you can't get yet? You know, like techniques evolve. I don't know. Also, the climate change issue, are you satisfied with what you get? Or are there things you wish you could get that you can't get in terms of science?
Well, you always want as much as you can get. And sometimes it's a matter of money. We'd love to have more sonars and more weirs and more fish counting, but we are limited, so we try to prioritize on that. But we also get, and we're doing a better job, I think, on getting taking advantage of local knowledge, especially on some of the rural areas. We've spent a lot of time this year on the Yukon River and the Kuskokwim River trying to make sure we visit and hear from people on those systems so we can understand the knowledge they've gained over the many centuries that they've been fishing up there. So we're doing a better job on that, and it's been very helpful.
I mean, I guess communities that are farther up the Yukon, they're the last ones to get the fish, right? So they want to make sure there's enough that gets there. So is that what you mostly hear from? Like, make sure we get our fish?
Well, yeah. Plus, we have a treaty with Canada that requires us to allow at least, I think it's about 42,000 Chinook salmon need to cross the border, and we're probably going to be over 100,000 this year. The Chinook salmon on the Yukon River this year is just an amazing success story, and people are generally happy. They're getting the subsistence needs are being met this year for Chinook salmon. So it's a pretty happy time on the Yukon.
Southeast is struggling, and the Yukon is doing well. That's just the way it goes.
Oh, and it's even more ironic that the Kuskokwim River had one of the lowest Chinook returns ever. And those two rivers, as you know, they're parallel systems, and one was up, one was down. And their nearshore environment is different for the smolt that are leaving the river system. So that probably is one of the reasons. But at the end of the day, the subsistence fishery on the Kuskokwim suffered a lot of restrictions this year, and the fishermen on the Yukon didn't.
I remember seeing headlines about Bethel fishermen not being able to get what they wanted, and I did not know it had gone so well on the Yukon. Yeah, that's great. Let's see. I want to bring in some of our other guests here. Dan, I'm thinking about you because I invited Dan specifically to have a scientist on the show, and Sam said to me, but we have tons of scientists in Fish and Game, and I know you do.
I work with lots of them,
yes,
too. Yes,
I figured that you do when you're an expert in Alaska on salmon. You're working with everybody, probably. But one of the things that I was, you know, hearing how the kings in Southeast are struggling, you know, on the Kuskokwim they're struggling, they're doing great on the Yukon, it made me think. Dan sent me a couple studies to read, you know, to sort of give me some background on where the science is. And just for the record, the study that showed in the Russian lake, 4,000 years of that it's cyclical and it goes up and it goes down. Am I interpreting that right?
Interestingly, we got word from the Journal of Paleolimnology that the study was accepted for publication just today.
Talk about obscure.
It's good timing, but it was a former graduate student of mine named Molly McCarthy. And it was her graduate work on the Kenai looking at sort of the deep history of sockeye salmon there. And
it's sockeye, not coho.
Yeah,
this
is sockeye.
Okay,
yeah, so, you know, the life history of sockeye is such that they often... they tend to spawn in lakes and in streams that flow into lakes, and the lakes sort of capture all those nutrients, and they become embedded in the lake sediments, and you can dig a sediment core from that lake and do some biochemical tricks to it and sort of reconstruct the history of sockeye salmon abundance in those lakes spanning back hundreds or thousands of years. And so Molly's work in the Kenai has actually produced, an Upper Russian Lake has produced the longest time series record of salmon abundance yet to date anywhere in the North Pacific or anywhere in the world for that matter. And one interesting feature of that abundance reconstruction is that it's been relatively stable over the last 4,000 years, except there was a period of about 600 years around the birth of Christ where the sockeye population in the lake went down to very low numbers. And interestingly, it coincided with some data from some research by Bruce Finney over on Kodiak Island, where he had cored Karluk and Iakulik Lake there and saw exactly the same pattern. So it just goes to show, well, for one thing, it shows the effect of climate, the climate can have on salmon.
Right.
And it also points to this sort of long-scale, regionally synchronous decline in salmon that lasted a really long time.
And then rebounded.
And then came back, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's the question before us. Are we going to, in our lifetime, live through the decline of salmon in Alaska? You know, but then you hear historically.
They're incredibly resilient animals, and they have a way of bouncing back. And they're here because they've bounced back. I mean, so much of Alaska was under ice, you know, 10, 15,000 years ago, and they've recolonized from that. And they've recolonized from volcanoes. And they're adaptable. They can handle disruption and disturbance.
Have a little faith in the salmon.
Give them some credit, yeah.
Okay. I'm just going to throw out our phone numbers for folks in case they want to participate in our conversation. It is in Anchorage. You can call us at 550-8433. Statewide, it's 1-888-353-5752. And we also welcome your email at hometown@alaskapublic.org. And in case you've joined us midstream and you know we're talking about salmon, I just want to let you know our guests today are Gayla Hassett from Dillingham, who's a subsistence research specialist with the Bristol Bay Native Association. Sam Cotton is the commissioner of Alaska Department of Fish and Game, a commercial fisherman in his lifetime, a sports fisherman, a legislator. He's done it all. He's here today to talk about the Department of Fish and Game. And we have Dan Ranella, who is a senior fisheries biologist with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. So join us in the conversation. And I think we should go to Gayla and just sort of check in with you because we haven't heard from you yet. You're from Dillingham. And actually, before the show, Gayla showed this amazing picture. I don't know if you saw it, Sam. You might not have been here yet. But go ahead and tell us about that picture. It's salmon-related.
Okay. I was putting out my subsistence net about a week and a half ago, and when we were gathering, I was counting how many fish I caught, and I'm like, oh, my gosh, I caught all five species of salmon. And for us to catch all five species of salmon in one catch, I mean, I haven't really heard of that happening in our area. And if it does happen, it happens, you know,
Very rarely.
Very rarely.
I wonder if it's an omen or a good sign.
Well,
or...
and I thought it was a good sign as we prepare for Alaska Wild Salmon Day and, you know, the fact that, you know, we do have all five species coming back. And it is really, really important that we do everything that we can to protect our salmon and our habitat areas. So
that's what you do for your work. You're a subsistence research specialist. So describe your job a little bit for us.
Okay. Well, I work at Bristol Bay Native Association. And what I do is I work with the Bristol Bay tribes and the Bristol Bay residents in the Bristol Bay area. And we help people get engaged and involved in the Board of Fish process, Board of Game, Federal Subsistence Board, all the regulatory processes that affect us in our area for fish and wildlife. Mm-hmm. So we are there at the Board of Fish meetings, and I'll just stick to fish because there's many different hats that we all wear. But so we help people with proposals. We help people find information or connect people who they need to talk to, you know, to make sure to get what they want to get done with the proposals that they are submitting, helping them in that process, working with teaching them the process. And what we wanted to start doing is bringing in more youth and bringing in the younger generation to teach them that they can be a part of the process. It is a public process, and we're very thankful for that opportunity within the state of Alaska that we can be a part of this public process so our voices can be heard, because every voice does make a difference. And
And I think that's when I was talking with Abby Frederick in your office, she was saying, you're going to hear this from Sam. He's going to talk about the public process and the importance of being there and weighing in. And so that's a thing that we can all agree on.
And Alaska is somewhat unique in that. Not all states give the public that kind of opportunity to put in proposals and testify in front of the board. So it's a lengthy process. Sometimes it gets a little more lengthy than people are hoping for, but we hear people. The board itself, of course, is appointed by the governor and has to be approved by the legislature. And there's the advisory committees, and we get a lot of advice. We have formal advisory committees for the board. That there are, I think we have 84 different advisory committees throughout Alaska.
Wow.
And they're given special status at the board. So if you're in an area that and you'd like to participate at that level, you're, like I said, given almost special treatment at the board. You get to testify longer. So they sometimes will call you back up to, you know, to participate. So In addition to the general public, you have the advisory committees.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of the public, we've got a caller, and I'd like to welcome Mary D. to Hometown Alaska. Hi, Mary. What's your question?
Hi. Nice to talk to you.
Yes.
My name is Mary D. Wheaton. My son, William Pierce, and I enjoy fishing and have lived here for a long time. I wondered if Mr. Cotton thinks that there's any kind of a threat from Japan or China in regards to our fishing industry.
Well, not directly. Since 1976, when the U.S. Congress passed the Magnuson-Stevens Act that extended our jurisdiction out 200 miles, we aren't as much under threat as we were before then, when foreign fleets could fish very close to Alaska. We have international organizations and treaty relationships with other countries that prevent high seas fishing, unrestricted, unreported fishing. So we're in much better shape these days than we've ever been in regard to threats from foreign fishermen.
Were you thinking of anything in particular, Mary D.?
Just having had the fun of college 100 years ago working in Kodiak, some of the fishermen there were concerned just about their fish being poached, so to speak, and some of my friends in Seattle have that same kind of thought filling of just outside threats.
Hmm. Limited resource, I guess, yeah.
Well, there are American fleets that fish inside the 200-mile limit with trawls that catch salmon, and that's a concern, and that's regulated as well. And I've sat on the North Pacific Fisheries Management Council for many years, and we regulate the federal waters, and we limit the amount of bycatch that can be taken in those trawl fleets.
Hmm.
There also isn't sort of an interesting indirect effect of Asian fisheries on Alaska's, in that There's some research that shows really high years of production from Asian fish hatcheries can negatively impact size and abundance of Alaska wild stocks. And the paper I'm thinking of in particular looked at Bristol Bay wild sockeye salmon interacting with Asian pink salmon on the high seas.
Wow.
Oh, it's a zero-sum game out there.
Yeah, that's remarkable. And it actually makes me want to, Dan, you and I, when we were getting ready for the show, talked about, let's explain the salmon life cycle a little bit so people understand where the salmon are going. And here they're going out into the Pacific and meeting salmon from Asia, and that could affect their genetics.
Not genetics, okay. but there's some evidence that they're competing for food on the high seas with Asian wild fish, but also Asian hatchery fish, of which there are a lot.
Yeah. So talk a little bit about the remarkableness of salmon, in case people aren't really fully aware of how they go away, they come back to the same, you know. I mean, we just go out there and fish and enjoy it, but they've been on quite a journey depending on the species, right?
So there's a lot of variation among species, but, you know, at this time of the year here in Alaska, we're seeing all these fish come back to our rivers, and they've been out at sea in different places, and there's some data about, you know, where they go and what they do when they're out there, but there's a lot that's not known. But they're on a migration right now, and they're coming back to Alaska's rivers to spawn, and they spawn in the summer, and coho spawn a little later in the fall. Those eggs will incubate in the gravel, mostly in streams, but some fish will spawn in lakes too, particularly some sockeye populations and some coho. They'll incubate all winter long through the long Alaska winter, and they will hatch sometime in late winter or spring, spend a little more time in the gravel absorbing their yolk sac, and then emerge from the gravel typically in the spring. Pink and chum salmon will go to sea soon after that. They spend very little time in freshwater. Chinook salmon will typically spend 1 year in freshwater before going to sea, and sockeye will, after they emerge, they'll migrate typically to a lake where they'll rear for a year or two before they go to sea. And coho salmon will spend typically two years in freshwater in streams, feeding and growing before they go to sea.
Mm-hmm.
And then they spend variable amounts of time at sea before they come back again. So yeah, they cover a lot of ground, and it's a really complicated life history.
Yeah. Is any species more hardy than another, or is that not even a fair question?
I don't even know how to answer that. I mean, some are. Like, I guess you can consider some to be a little weedier than others. You know, like pink salmon have a really short life history, and they stray a lot, and they're not real specific about their habitat use. But I don't know if you could consider them to be hardier or not. They're just.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And what this question of the coho and sort of the experience in the Upper Cook Inlet, is that happening elsewhere in Alaska? Do you know that the coho returns are low? I'm looking at Sam, but I, just because he might know if there have been closures. I was wondering if they are somehow not a weaker species, but a more fragile species or something like that. Harder to predict.
Yes.
And why is that?
Well, they're just they don't follow the same patterns, and they're just it's just harder to forecast, you know, runs of coho. This year it looks like we've got a tremendous run of coho in Cook Inlet.
Mm-hmm.
We weren't able to predict that, and it looks like it might even be a little bit late, so that enters into a lot of forecasting and hand-wringing as well. So
yeah,
I imagine their long freshwater life history complicates the forecasting for coho too, because you really have a hard time knowing how many are actually going to sea after 2 years in freshwater.
And there again, it becomes a money question. You can do smolt out migration counts, but every one of those costs a lot of money, and it's you just can't do everything.
Yeah. What I was getting at with, and it's just a generalist question, like, is there a canary in the gold mine or in the coal mine here? You know, like one species is floundering, and therefore it's the beginning of the. And you would say no, that's they're just different, and there's many, many factors influencing how a run goes in any given year. So
yeah, they all use their habitat in different sorts of ways, and and things have a way of getting complicated and hard to predict.
Yeah. Well, we're going to take a tiny break here. And when we come back, we do have a caller on the line, Angie. I met Angie, and I know that she's done research about China's interest in fish heads. So we're going to come back and hear a little bit about that. And I just thought it was interesting to think there are other revenues for Alaska from salmon that we might not have explored yet. So we're going to take a little break. You're listening to Hometown Alaska. I'm Kathleen McCoy.
You're listening to Hometown Alaska from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 8 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Hometown Alaska on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back to Hometown Alaska. We were having a little bit of a conversation in here on the break, and you heard us talking, but we're back now. And just to remind you, we're talking about Alaska salmon. It's kind of time to the state-designated day of August 10th, which is tomorrow, to celebrate and learn about salmon. And so we dedicated our show today to just talking about salmon. We have Gayla Hassett here from Dillingham, who is a subsistence research specialist and a fisher person herself. And we have Sam Cotton, who's the commissioner of Alaska Department of Fish and Game, and Dan Ranella, who's a senior fisheries biologist for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And we've been trying to talk about the different species, you know, some of the news. We're in the hot and heavy salmon harvest season, and there's been good news, and then there's been, you know, emergency closures to sort of make sure to protect this this resource. So we've been going back and forth about that, a little bit about the science. But we do have a caller, and I'm going to welcome Angie on to Hometown Alaska. Hi, Angie.
Hi, Catherine.
I did tell our listeners that I actually did meet you before, and I know that you're a professor in the business school at UAA, and that you have been thinking about other markets for Alaska salmon and sort of researching China, which is where you are from. Tell us a little bit about your work, just so people are aware of it.
Yes, yeah, I definitely like to share my research with you and with the audience so people know there is another potential market for Alaska wild salmon. So basically, the research we have done is called Consumer Preference and the Market Potential for Alaska Salmon in China. So this is already published. If audience are interested, they can look up the title and to read the full report. So basically, we conducted the research report trying to better understand Chinese consumers' preference for salmon and its attributes and assess their perceptions of Alaska wild salmon. The goal is to assess the emerging demand and market potential for Alaska salmon in China market by evaluating urban Chinese consumers' preference. So specifically, we designed a consumer survey and implemented in China in summer 2015. So we interviewed more than 1,000 consumers in three cities, including Beijing, Shanghai, and Guangzhou. And in the survey, we built in all different kinds of questions, including consumers' purchase patterns and preference for seafood, their salmon consumption habits and preference for salmon attributes, their perceptions of and attitudes towards Alaska salmon, and also their willingness to purchase Alaska salmon fillet and heads and bones.
Angie, did you say to purchase bones? And what was the other pieces?
Heads and bones.
Oh, heads, yeah. And bones. Okay.
So in addition to fillet, we also ask questions related to salmon heads and bones.
Uh-huh. Okay. And so summarize for us what you found out. Are we exporting salmon bones and salmon fish heads to China yet, or are you still trying to find out how to do that?
Yeah, actually... So since 2011, China has been Alaska's number one export market. So we do export a good number of salmon to China. Some of the exported salmon were processed in China but re-exported to other countries. Some remain in China market. So So based on my own observation, so for this research project, we interviewed at around 30 supermarkets in China. Hmm. Before that, personally, I visited another 30 supermarkets in China to figure out the price range for my choice experiment design. So out of the 60 supermarkets, actually, I never seen Alaska wild salmon on sale in mainland China's supermarket. So basically, based on my observation, actually, I'm not sure where the Alaska salmon bones or heads go in China. So now in China market, all the salmon are dominated by Norway and Chile salmon. There were salmon fillet, steaks, chunks, or heads and bones or skins, tails on sale on the market, but none of them are from Alaska.
Ah, okay. So there's other countries that are already recognizing the potential here. Uh-huh.
Yeah, but they sell farm-raised salmon. And here, my research, I try to figure out consumers' preference for all different attributes of salmon, including the method of harvest, which means the wild versus farm-raised salmon.
Mm-hmm. And is there a preference for wild over farmed, or do people even make that distinction over there?
Yes, they do. So actually, we found a number of interesting results. So basically, talking about Alaska, people do value the pure and clean environment of Alaska salmon, and they state that Alaska origin plays an important role in their seafood purchasing decision.
Hmm.
And it surprised us how many of them know Alaska already. They recognize Alaska already. And talking about attributes, so out of the 6 salmon attributes we listed in the survey question, Chinese consumers rank method of harvest, which means wild versus farm-raised, mm-hmm. as the most important attribute they care for their salmon consumption.
Hmm.
So it's followed by environmentally acceptable certificates, color, method of preservation, country of origin, and fat content. Mm-hmm. But method of harvest, wild versus farm-raised, was ranked number one.
You know, Angie, did you grow up in China, and did you suspect that, for example, I think you had said that the bones, for example, or fish heads might be discarded by some Alaska fishermen, and that you saw potential for that in China. Is that where the idea for this came from?
Yeah, actually, that's part of the idea. So in the research, I also asked questions related to salmon fillet. So was their willingness to pay for the salmon fillet? But we also built in the question related to heads and bones.
Hmm.
So basically, there is a difference between Chinese and American culinary tradition. So in China, the culinary tradition is that we usually eat fish heads and bones for various soups or stews, and the Chinese consider those meals as healthy meals.
Mm-hmm.
So here, although from time to time we saw salmon parts on sale in market, but those are in very low values. So the American consumers mainly consume the salmon fillet.
Mm-hmm.
But in China, if you look at the market, actually I think I have the supermarket pictures in my report. So wherever mm-hmm. it has salmon fillet on sale, there's always heads, bones, tails, and skins sold hmm. together.
Well, every single piece used is interesting.
Yes, exactly.
Uh-huh.
And that belongs to the culinary tradition.
Mm. Well, I was just going to invite Gayla in because I told during the break that we were going to bring you on, and she mentioned that some use of fish heads is very traditional Alaska Native culture. It may not be maybe for urban fisher people, maybe less so, but it's still very, very well used in Alaska Native culture.
Yeah, we love our fish heads. And when the king salmon are the first species to come back, and with the first king salmon, I mean,
that's the best one.
It is. And so we'll cut up the heads and we boil the heads. And if it's a female, we'll boil the eggs and have fish heads and eggs.
Yeah.
And everybody, it's a delicacy, and a lot of people turn their nose up to it, but they haven't tried it. And Sam said that he tried some, so I'm glad that he was able to partake in
it. He's a convert.
It was pretty good.
Yeah. He's a convert. Well, it's just interesting because it is true that many people don't use them. And here's a market opening up potentially for revenue for Alaska fishermen. But then there's been this long use, you know, traditional use. And so it's just kind of fun to share that information, I thought.
That is really fun. And I'm really glad to hear that there is a market for that. And that's really good for our fishermen out there, too, to look into that. We don't, and with the fish heads too, we do various things with it. We also salt them and we make salunux. So you salt the fish heads and then you soak out the fish heads and you make salunux with it. You can make pickled heads with it. So there's a lot of things that we do with the fish heads.
That's great. Well, Angie, I want to thank you for calling in and participating in the conversation and sharing this, because I think most people don't know that potential market is out there. And it kind of validates the use of fish heads and the quality that has been known for a long time among Alaska's oldest residents. So I guess I'm just going to say thank you.
Okay, thank you, Kathleen.
Yeah, and I did post that, as I mentioned, I posted some of the papers from, or some of the websites where research is being done. I did post that paper on alaskapublic.org if people want to learn more about it. It's still going to unfold, I guess, but it's just interesting. So thanks a lot, Angie. I appreciate the call.
Yeah, thank you, Kathleen. Bye.
All right, bye-bye. I am going to share our number one more time with folks in Anchorage. It's 550-8433 statewide, 1-888-353-5752, or email at hometown@alaskapublic.org. I did want to mention that there's all these events tomorrow that are celebrating Alaska. We've got a link on our website, and I'm sure you're seeing it around town. There are restaurants that are focusing on salmon. There is a big public, Cuddy Park at 5 o'clock, I think, tomorrow is a big public event. So, you know, that's part of why we've focused on this. And by the way, Sam and I were talking just briefly. It was the Speaker of the House who put this bill forward that got this day, and you said you wanted to give credit where credit is due on that. So tell me a little bit about that.
Well, Representative Bryce Edgman represents Dillingham in the state legislature. And he is the Speaker of the House.
Mm-hmm.
And at first, you know, people will propose things like a special day, but this really took off and got a lot of interest. And already we're seeing, you know, shows like this, informational opportunities, educational opportunities, promotional opportunities.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really highlighting, you know, how important salmon is to so many people in Alaska. And so I appreciate Representative Edgman's efforts on this, and thank him again.
Yeah.
I say a big thank you to Bryce, too, for doing that, and especially coming from Bristol Bay. It was to get recognition for salmon and wild salmon and how important it is. And it benefits all of us here in Alaska, but it benefits a lot of people around the world.
Right. And I think it highlights that you can take something for granted, but you actually need to learn more about it to understand it. I know the scientists are doing that, but even the consumer needs to know and can gauge their harvesting and all kinds of things, you know, what the Department of Fish and Game is trying to do. The individual consumer can also do. They want this to last a long time. So anyway, I just thought that was interesting. And just to name my guests one more time, we have Gayla Hassett here from Dillingham, Sam Cotton and Dan Ranella. We're talking science, we're talking policy, we're talking subsistence. And I'm going to welcome one more caller on the line. Hi, Doug. You're on Hometown Alaska.
Yeah, hi, great show. Enjoying this a lot. I had kind of two questions I was interested in trying to get some insight on. One is, for the longest time, a big black hole with salmon has been some of their the ocean environment, especially like the nearshore ocean. I've worked out in western Alaska for a long time, and I heard about a lot of this research they're doing, some of the nearshore, trying to get a better handle on what's going on with salmon there. And I guess they were doing it mostly on the Yukon, but they're trying to move into Kuskokwim and maybe Bristol Bay for some of these research. I think it's cooperative projects between National Marine Fisheries Service and Fish and Game. And that's one thing. I'm wondering how that's going. And with all the budget problems that are happening with the state and even federal cuts, how stable that might be. And the other thing I was looking for some insights on, just comments, was about genetics. The more I hear about genetics, the utility of genetics as a tool for teasing out what fish are being caught where, different stocks, I just find that stuff fascinating. So I don't know if Mr. Cotton there could maybe address some of the questions on budgets and whether there's any stability with trying to keep some of these initiatives going.
Okay.
I'll give us a stab at it, and I suspect Dan's going to
chime in here too. He was making notes while you were talking, so go ahead, Dan.
But as far as the research, we've been working very well with National Marine Fisheries Service and with U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. We do share a lot of information. As Dan points out, we work together a lot, and it's important research that we had a specified amount of money that was appropriated by the legislature specifically for Chinook salmon research. And it was supposed to be in the neighborhood of $30 million.
I have a link to that on the Chinook Initiative.
But as budget got crunched further, that it got reduced. And so, but meanwhile, we've done a lot of work, and as the gentleman just suggested, primarily in Western Alaska, focused on the nearshore marine environment on the Yukon River, and we were able to forecast some better returns as a result of some of that research. But we're also trying to find out, you know, what problems the fish are encountering there.
You don't have that report in front of you, so I mean, can you be a little? What you've learned? What have you learned?
Well, we have a professional on our staff, Dr. Katie Howard, who goes up into the Bering Sea, goes aboard a trawl vessel. We sample some of the catch in a trawl, and we look for juvenile salmon there. And so we determine abundance, health of the stocks, size. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So you're trying to determine not only what kind of shape they're in now, but, you know, if there's any evidence that there were problems on the river. So we're trying to learn as much as we can about those fish. But mm-hmm. One thing that was pretty clear was that in the last couple of years, there are high abundance in that area. And so she's predicting that since the nearshore marine environment around the Kuskokwim is quite a bit different, that different conditions prevailed there to perhaps influence the decline there. So we're going to try to do some work down there as well, funds allowing.
Interesting. And Dan, do you have anything to add there?
Yeah, I would. There's sort of an interesting theory in that gets a lot of press these days, and that's about how, you know, the ocean conditions when juvenile salmon first hit the sea, like if they and my expertise more or less ends at the shoreline, so
this is
I'm
you're the freshwater.
Tiptoeing out of my realm here.
That's fair.
So you know, like the whole timing of salmon spawning in freshwater and the length of time required to incubate, they're sort of aiming ahead, you know, biologically to put those juveniles into the marine environment at a time that's hospitable. Mm-hmm. And a lot of mortality can occur, you know, early on in the marine phase. And oftentimes that early marine mortality seems to sort of set the trajectory for the strength of a run.
So it sounds like those cooperative efforts are going to continue, although budgets are an issue, but they haven't stalled out completely, huh, Sam?
No. In fact, I think, again, we appreciate working with, we don't always agree with the feds or the different services, but they're good professional folks, and we have been working well together. The gentleman online also asked about genetics.
Right.
Would you like to say?
Yes, I'd love to do that.
We've done a lot of work on that, and that's getting we're getting better at it. We're learning more about it. There were competing methodologies, and we've kind of centered, I think, the universal language refers to SNPs, which is an acronym that I won't get into, but what you're doing is you're taking a chunk of fish flesh and doing a DNA sample on it after you've done a baseline. So you go to a river or a stream someplace in Alaska, get the DNA from that fish, and then when you catch a fish in the ocean, you can identify where that fish is going.
Okay.
And so there's a lot of different reasons to do that, not the least of which is for better management practices. So you can regulate fishing to perhaps avoid taking a lot of fish that might be headed someplace else.
Mm-hmm.
But it also gets a little political, because in recent years there was some genetic data that suggested that the fishermen in Kodiak were catching a lot of fish that were sockeye salmon or headed for Cook Inlet. So what that did was raise, you know, hackles on the people up this way. And the Kodiak folks got into a pretty defensive mode there. But intercept fisheries have been going on ever since there's been salmon, and that's not going to change. But it is good to know as much as you can about the origins, and that, and you do it through the genetic work, the DNA.
Mm, wow, that's interesting, and that's relatively new. The genetic the effort with genes and.
It's I don't know how new it really is, but I know that we're doing more of it. We're able to do it faster. The turnaround time when you send a sample in and get it back is much quicker than it used to be.
Yeah.
It's probably less expensive.
Yeah. Huh. And Dan, anything? Did you want to say something, Doug?
One other thing. I just heard from a guy the other day in the Kuskokwim, there's a question about upper river kings versus lower river kings and how the dynamics are going on. And they are actually going to go back to scale samples they've collected from that subsistence fishermen collected, and they're going to go back to those scales and figure out which stocks were being harvested, 10, 12 years ago. I just find that fascinating.
Let me just say one other thing about that, and that's some of the work that we've done out in the Bering Sea with the pollock fleets, who do catch a lot of Chinook salmon.
Yeah.
So we do the DNA work on those fish to see where they're headed, and the preponderance of those fish are headed for Western Alaska. Mm. Whereas in the Gulf of Alaska, we do the genetic work on the Chinook salmon captured in the pollock fishery, and it's less than 10% Alaska fish. It's typically hatchery fish from Pacific Northwest and British Columbia.
Huh.
So that gives us better information when we regulate bycatch.
Interesting. So, Doug, both were really good questions. It took us to some things we hadn't talked about before.
Okay, well, thank you very much for the program. Enjoying it.
Thank you. Let me think. We have about 10 minutes left. What haven't we covered? What do you think we should... There's so much that we could talk about. I had notes like... for Sam, thinking about farm salmon is still prohibited in Alaska, right?
That's correct.
So that hasn't changed yet. I saw other things in the news about labor issues with salmon processing. Does Fish and Game get into that, or is that just a Department of Labor issue?
I think you have that right. It's more a Department of Labor issue, but it does affect the fishing industry in some ways. For example, in Bristol Bay this year, they complained they didn't have enough help. And so
that's kind of what the
processors had to put fishermen on limit, so it affected the bottom line for some of the folks out there. And so it does affect fish and game management. But it is more of a Department of Labor or even a federal issue with the J-1 visas, or which I can't remember which designation it was, but a visa was required. And it used to be if you'd been here before, you were allowed to come back. And under the new rules, that's not the case. So processors had a hard time finding enough help.
Interesting. That's interesting. I was thinking about, I read some of this. Angie talked about China being the main recipient for a lot of Alaska salmon where it gets processed there. It makes you wonder, is that a labor issue too? But again, it's kind of out of your expertise. But
well, not it probably is. But I do know that, in fact, some round fish go to China. And that means they haven't even been cleaned. They're frozen whole. And that's probably an opportunity for the Chinese to take advantage of all parts of the fish.
Mm-hmm.
It's not very economically worthwhile to ship fish heads the plants have limitations on how much they can freeze, and if the fish are coming in strong, they're going to go straight to the flesh. If it's early in the season or late in the season, there's not as much fish coming through, they'll grind up all the unused fish parts and put them in a tray and freeze them and sell them to people that make cat food. So, but they're not going to do that when their capacity is full on just trying to get the flesh.
Huh. Interesting. Here's a science question, but I don't know if as we get warmer, are fish moving north to cooler waters? That's a very broad general question. What do you think?
Well, I'm going to defer to the scientists on this, but I do know that with pollock, you're seeing that in the Bering Sea as the temperatures go up. They're in different locations. And as the ice isn't as prevalent, you see fish up on the north slopes, and salmon go up into the Sagamitoc River and even up into Canada sometimes, all the way across.
Mm-hmm.
So I think climate would affect their ability to pass that way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's been some work on this recently. I don't think there are big populations yet.
in the Arctic Ocean, but there's potentially some evidence that there are more fish using that area. But there's good habitat there, but they're sort of limited by sea ice and, you know, really cold conditions and fresh water and some other.
And also where they traditionally go, right? They don't seek out new places.
Oh, but they do.
Oh, they do. Okay, so there I'm wrong.
This is
the resilience.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Let me think. What else? What haven't we talked about that you think? I know some of the papers you sent me, Dan, that talked about as glaciers melt, that might actually help salmon habitat because sediment sometimes can be a problem for.
Yeah.
I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, that's a really complicated question. South Central Alaska and the Gulf of Alaska region is losing a lot of glacial mass and glacial coverage, and that definitely affects the temperature and the stream flow and rivers. Like the Kenai River gets a lot of water in the summertime from glaciers, and the Kenai River, as we know, has a couple big lakes on it that settle out a lot of that glacial silt, and so. That's a really productive system because of this sort of interplay between the lakes and the flow from glaciers. But if you look at other rivers that don't have those lakes and they get a lot of just straight, you know, glacial water, they tend to be very silty and very cold, and they're not great salmon habitat.
Mm-hmm.
But as glacial flow decreases over time, it's possible that those may actually become better salmon streams.
Mm-hmm.
And in some cases where you have a small amount of glacial coverage and they're not impacting and creating a lot of silt, that and you lose that glacial coverage, you may lose summer flow and habitat connectivity, and that may be bad for salmon in some places. So you know, I think like an overriding theme to any aspect of climate change is that there will probably be winners and losers, and that it will be hard to predict who those are.
Right. And I want to go to you, Gaylev, because, we bounced around a lot of science and policy, but let's talk a little bit about life in Dillingham. And, I know you do advocacy work for sure. We talked a little bit about that, but I'm just interested. We will post that picture. If you email it to me, I'm going to post it. But just I just thought I'd go back to you and let you talk a little bit about the rhythm of life and fish and a home and, sort of the traditions that you want to make sure don't go away.
Okay. Thank you, Kathleen. Fish is everything revolves around salmon in rural Alaska. And that's something that we definitely want to definitely protect. These are our people have been fishing for fish for thousands of years. And I know that we haven't had any much time or too much time to talk about it, but the fish permitting process in the state of Alaska, needs to be reexamined and looked at. And with Stand for Salmon, looking at how we could protect our fish habitat areas. And
I wish, is there a ballot initiative? I think I read something that people are going to see this in the news.
Yeah, there's HB 199.
Okay.
So people could tune into more about that, and you could check it on standforsalmon.org for more information. Uh-huh. But I know that we're running out of time, but that's a really key area that we want to focus on, is how do we make sure that we have the protections in place to protect our salmon, because we want our fish to come back, and we want this resource to not be depleted or, to have any kind of harm.
Mm-hmm.
So that's really, really important to us. And that could probably be a whole show in itself. But that's just something that I wanted to put out there as well.
Yeah. Well, you hear the music. It means that we're just about done. So I want to thank Dr. Dan Ranella, Sam Cotton, the Commissioner of Alaska Department of Fish and Game, and Gayla Hasseth. And, of course, callers and listeners. We had some good questions today, so thank you. I'll be back next week when we resume Justice Alaska on Hometown Alaska, joined by my co-host, Senior Judge Elaine Andrews. Our guest next week is Alaska's Attorney General, Jonna Lendemuth, who heads the Alaska Department of Law and tackles important issues in the state, from Arctic development to corrections reform to tribal sovereignty. We hope you'll join us. Find us on the web at alaskapublic.org. Dave Waldron is our audio engineer today. Thanks for joining us on Hometown Alaska. I'm Kathleen McCoy.
Hometown Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Hometown Alaska's theme song, Lead Dog, is by Kevin Barnett from Eagle River. Learn more about Hometown Alaska and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.